Welcome everybody, my name is Krush AK and this is the Market Meditations Podcast. We chat with fascinating people from around the world to extract mindsets, routines, stories and habits to help you build richer lives. Meditators, today we have with us Jameson Lopp, the CTO and co-founder of Casa. He is one of the foremost experts in privacy and security in the cryptocurrency space. He's solving and finding security flaws for both the individuals and the large enterprises as well. There's so much value add in this episode. I highly recommend you listen and apply the advice he gives. Before we jump into this episode, don't forget that I send hand-picked market news, insights, and education to over 6,000 traders and investors 3 times a week. To get access to this, all you have to do is sign up to krushak.substack.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Market Meditations Podcast. Today, I've got a guest very different to anything we've had on the show before. This is mainly focused on traders, investors, and entrepreneurs, specifically in the crypto space. One thing we've not had quite enough of is security focus episodes. You can be your own bank, but with that comes an immense amount of responsibility, and this is one of the foremost experts in the world on privacy and security in the space. Jameson, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start by asking why you care so much about privacy and security, and why you've chosen to dedicate your life and specifically in the crypto space to this venture.
Well, you know, it started off kind of luck/accident. When I really started looking for full-time employment in the space back at the end of 2014, there weren't a ton of options. Most of the employers out there were the exchanges because they were the only businesses making any money. And I applied at Coinbase, got rejected. And I also applied at BitGo and managed to make it through their interview process. And even though they were not looking to hire remote developers, I was on the other side of the United States. I convinced them to give me a 3-month free trial. And after that worked out well, it turned into a full-time thing. And so working at BitGo is what really got me deep into the security side of things. While I was not working directly for an exchange, I was actually, in a way, working for dozens, if not hundreds, of different exchanges, because BitGo is essentially a security service provider for anyone who wanted to run an enterprise-level hot wallet that had a high degree of security compared to what most people would roll themselves. So that set me down the security path, and then it was a couple of years later, which was really, once again, a result of sort of luck and just, I guess, sheer determination of how much I tweet and getting a larger audience, that resulted in me getting attention from people that I would prefer not to have attention from. And that eventually led to a sort of extortion situation where my whole neighborhood got locked down by the police, and there was basically false bomb threat that was called in from someone claiming to be me. You know, that just turned into a whole situation that I did not want to have to deal with ever again. And I decided at that point in time that I was going to have to take on a new project, which was to really push the boundaries of privacy to do the best that I could to ensure that some random person on the internet couldn't just, you know, find my information and target me. So here we are several years later, and so far, so good.
That is really unfortunate. I'm sorry that happened to you. I've had nothing close to that, but some instances where I've had cyber attacks where people have taken over my computer and typed things at me. It's what happens when you put your face out there. Again, that the level of that, I'm sure, is very different to what you experienced. Now, for me, that was quite traumatic. Your decision to go into pursuing privacy and security so much, how much of that was driven by a sense of I need to logically go do this? And also sentimentally and emotionally, I don't want this to happen to anyone else. That's why I'm pursuing this.
Yeah. So, you know, privacy and security are kind of like two sides to the same coin. You can certainly focus on one more than the other. And, you know, I was already focused on security because of my work at BitGo and seeing a lot of bad things happen. I saw a lot of mistakes. I wrote a blog post a few months ago, the do's and don'ts of like Bitcoin key management, in which I basically did a brain dump of everything I've ever seen go wrong. And, you know, I think that's probably about 10 pages worth of different incidents. And so, you know, I was already good on the, at least on the digital security side. I would say that I had actually been interested in physical security well before Bitcoin. You know, when it comes to personal defense, I had been into firearms, for example, since I was legally allowed to. I guess when I turned 21 in the U.S., you can get handguns. You can get long guns earlier than that, but I was at university at the time, and they tend to frown upon that. So I started off, you know, with firearms, which is common in America. And eventually, I felt like I wanted to go further, and I took about 2 years of instruction with Krav Maga, in which I learned blade and stick training and hand-to-hand combat. And you know, that was a really good experience, not just because it, you know, showed me how to, you know, both offensively and defensively use non-firearm weapons, because even in America, we don't always have a gun on us. There are a lot of places you can't take guns. But it showed me what my physical limits were, and it made me realize that if you have the right mental attitude, you can, you know, do a lot more than you probably believe that you can. And, you know, that was definitely the most grueling experience that I ever went through. Some of the sort of end of level course challenges that I had there, you know, I felt like I was going to die, essentially. Wow. You know, they were like 3 hour long, 110% of everything that you were capable of doing, you know, basically like, you know, military basic training type of stuff where they were just trying to break you mentally.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I found that side of things very interesting. And I think, you know, you can then apply those concepts to many other things in your life. And so you spoke earlier about how you mostly talk to traders and entrepreneurs and whatever. And, you know, regardless of what your vocation is or what your hobbies are and you focus on, I think that, you know, getting yourself into the perseverance mindset and the ability to accept failure and learn from it and move on and realize that, you know, even usually like the worst thing that has ever happened to you in your life is it's not the end of your life. If you're still breathing, you know, you can still learn and keep going. So, you know, it's fairly long diatribe there, I guess, of, you know, how I kind of got sparked off into the mindset. And, you know, over the years, it has just sort of morphed into applying that mindset to a number of different things. And so, you know, I've had other incidents that are personal to me that I have considered opportunities. You know, getting swatted was a terrible day in my life, but I actually believe that the attacker did me one of the biggest favors that he could have, because if anything, like, that has resulted in me researching and learning more about this whole new sphere than I had ever anticipated happening. And then when I turn around and I try to educate people about that, you know, that has only, I think, resulted in my prominence growing, at least in the security and privacy mindset space, because a lot of people who do this, they're not the sharing types. And, you know, that's something that will probably come up again as we're talking about security, is that for some reason, even a lot of security-minded and privacy-minded individuals have this belief that you know, security through obscurity has value. So, you know, if I can't tell people, at least generally, what I am doing to secure myself and to make myself more private, then you know, I'm just relying on the hope that they don't find out what my techniques are. And that's very weak, brittle type of security.
Wow. Okay. There's so much there for me to address. Normally I interrupt in the middle, but every talking point was so interesting, I couldn't stop. So it seems like it wasn't a sentimental decision for you. It was something that has always been a part of your personality and something you've been serious about even before crypto. I love that you mentioned Krav Maga as an example. One of my closest friends is actually the special forces trainer for the Israeli Special Forces, Krav Maga, and I've trained with him. So definitely not top tier stuff, but lots of fun. And I see the value. It's very much not a martial art. It is a self-defense. And what you went on to next about mindset. One common theme we've had on this show nonstop, whether it be traders, investors, entrepreneurs, CTOs, CEOs, whoever is successful in anything they do, it all stems from mindset. And I actually wasn't expecting to see, even with security, that this stems from mindset as well. Having the right mindset, the perseverance to get attacked and then come back stronger every single time. It is, whether it be a trading mistake where you lose a lot of money or a security mistake where you get hacked, whenever it happens, it could have happened later when you had a lot more to lose, a lot more money, or it could have been a lot worse. So it's almost a bit of a blessing when it does happen. Now, I've commented on a lot of what you said, but I'd like to go back to the very start, something you mentioned, which was that security and privacy aren't the same thing, but they do coexist. And then you also mentioned how with privacy, every decision you make has an opportunity cost. So it's not just privacy increases. There's got to be a financial cost, a mental cost, a freedom cost. What are the differences between security and privacy? Can one exist without the other? And how do you find balance?
Yeah, so I consider them to be kind of like different layers of your shield. And I also have written extensively about this in some of my posts this year about physical defense and home defense and whatnot. And security is like your shield that you're actually holding, where, you know, someone is attacking it, and that security mechanism, whatever it is, you know, physically or digitally just blocking them. You know, it's a firewall type of mechanism. I consider privacy to be kind of like an outer layer. Consider it like a moat, or, you know, a barbed wire fence that's further out on the perimeter. And if you have really strong privacy, then an attacker won't even be able to get to your security. Like, they won't be able to find that real final layer of defense to attack it in the first place. So this is another type of mindset that I talk about often, is that security and privacy are not, you shouldn't think of them as a single layer or a binary thing. Instead, what you want is a multitude and a diversity of different types of privacy and different types of security. This is, once again, it's something that gets applied to all types of privacy and security and all types of spheres, is because if you're relying on, you know, one single piece of privacy or security to keep you safe, then that's a single point of failure. You never want to have a single point of failure in anything that you're architecting. That's the major premise upon which Casa is architected. But the more layers that you have, you have to assume that none of them are perfect and that they may get compromised. And so you essentially want to make it so aggravating for an attacker, you know, that they, even if they get through one layer, they just immediately run into another layer, and that just confounds them even further. And what that is doing from a practical standpoint is it's raising the cost of a successful attack. And especially when it comes to privacy, there is no perfect privacy. What you're really doing is you're instituting so many different layers that you are raising the cost to a level that you hope and anticipate that a given attacker simply is not willing to commit the resources in order to penetrate through all of that. So, you know, this is when I talk about my own privacy setup. Even though I'm probably in the 0.01%, you know, top tier threshold of privacy. If an attacker was willing to spend millions of dollars, they could probably find me. So I do not have, you know, nation state level privacy resistance, but that's not my goal. My primary goal is just to keep the rando butthurt person sitting in a basement away from being able to find my physical location and target me.
So I know you've spent a lot of time, energy, and resources in developing this level of privacy. Is it for just the rando butthurt person? Or like, surely there's got to be more you're trying to protect yourself from. Or maybe not surely, maybe I'm being naive. The rando butthurt person can do a lot of damage.
Yeah, so, you know, that's what I consider to be the more common type of attack. And obviously, that's the attack that actually happened to me. So there is documented evidence that this is a real threat, at least against me. And I would say that's a real threat against anyone who is prominent and has tens of thousands, but definitely if you have hundreds of thousands of people in your audience who are paying attention to you, because it becomes a numbers game at that point. You know, this is not a unique problem. It's a problem that any celebrity and politician has had to deal with going back throughout human history, really. The difference now is that it's the cost of someone reaching out to you has become so much lower just due to the internet, the ability for information to flow so cheaply, that attack cost has gone to almost zero if someone has the right skills. So obviously there are plenty of other potential threats. And, you know, when I extrapolate out, you know, I have a repository where I keep track of all of the known physical attacks against people in this space. And there is a very strong correlation between the exchange rate and the amount of physical attacks that happen, especially with the recent Ledger leak of 250,000 physical addresses. I'm very interested to see if we get a big spike in physical attacks. You know, that type of attack is very low probability because the attacker is putting themselves and their life in physical danger by doing it. But, you know, if an attacker gets information and then they're doing reconnaissance, and basically any attacker is going to be weighing the odds, you know, what is the cost and what is the potential reward of a successful attack here. So, you know, if they're able to determine that, hey, you know, someone who lives in this very specific house has millions of dollars in liquid crypto bearer assets, and all I have to do is, you know, put a weapon up against them to get that in, you know, a matter of hours, that's a very, very high reward. While it's also high risk, I mean, it's probably safer than robbing a bank.
I mean, it is robbing a bank. Like, we're trying to be our own bank, so it just makes robbing a bank easier.
Yeah, and the problem, and I mean, this is the problem that I've been focused on for 6 years now, is that, you know, if we want to be our own banks, we have to realize that it's possible to have better than bank level security, but the vast majority of people who are even bothering to take custody of their keys in the first place are nowhere near that. So we've got a long ways to go. And this is why security, I think, is important, not only at a personal level, but at a macro level, is that, once again, like I said, the risk and rewards will continue to be weighed by these attackers as the Bitcoin space becomes more prominent. You know, more criminally minded people are going to be poking at it and trying to figure out if there are good opportunities for them. And the only way that we're going to really be able to prevent, you know, widespread attacks like this from happening is to make it a common thing that type of physical attack is not feasible because the person is not putting all of their money in one place where they can be easily coerced into, you know, sending their entire life savings with a few clicks of a button.
I think I heard you say this, even if we protect our keys and make sure that it's impossible for anyone who gets into our home to take them, aren't we relying on them believing us that we don't have it? So simply the fact that we own it and it is known that we own that puts us in severe danger. And what would the solution be around that, besides investing a whole lot into your personal security when you become your own bank, which almost puts an argument away from crypto, and that could be a significant inhibitor to mass adoption?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot of sort of intermingling factors, and I think a lot of people mix them up too much. So there's the security of your actual keys. You know, that's one thing you have to think about completely separately. That security is generally completely unrelated to your physical security of your body. So, you know, that's a whole other problem set that, you know, Bitcoin and like the ability to be self-sovereign, yada, 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 that doesn't solve anything about the physical security of your body, your home, your family, your pets, whatever. On the plus side, that type of physical security is a problem that has existed for all of human existence. And there is a lot of great solutions that are already out there. You know, if you're willing to put in the time and the resources, you know, you have to invest in security upfront, because I consider security to just be a preemptive form of insurance. So, you know, a lot of people in the space talk about insurance products, you know, after the fact insurance products. I'm not a big fan of those because, you know, those are just trusted third parties that you already know are incentivized to screw you over and not pay out if something happens. And like, I don't want to have to deal with that. I would rather just prevent the bad thing from happening in the first place and be confident that it's not going to happen. And then, of course, there's also privacy, like I said before, which is yet another completely separate facet to all of this. And so, you know, if you're focused on just like your total security well-being, you have to approach it from all of these different angles in order to have, you know, the strongest shield. You know, almost consider it like chain link mesh. You know, if you have links in the chain missing, then those are weaknesses. So pretty much everybody has, you know, room for improvement regardless of how much resources they've devoted to it.
I love the analogy of privacy being the barbed wire preventing people from even testing your shield in the first place. It really helps visualize the importance. In fact, for my shield, I was thinking... just researching you made me want to have a guard dog, a dog that is capable of upping security. It really made me think about things I haven't thought about before, because even though you said that this is a problem we've thought about forever, previously, it's not very easy to get into someone's house and get out with $2 million, for example, a random sum. Crypto makes that a lot easier, which is why I feel the solutions we had before might need to be elevated, but always has been a risk. So as an average person who doesn't really have any barbed wire right now or a shield, what is commonly overlooked? What can our listeners spend 1 hour doing after this to level up their security and something that most people don't do?
So on the privacy side, the easy thing to do, it's just behavioral changes. It's, you know, stop putting your name and address and personal contact information into every database that you come across. This is a mindset change that is difficult at first, because essentially what I'm telling people to do is to lie. In the vast majority of cases, when you're interacting with a third party, you know, a merchant or whatever, you are under no legal obligation to give them your real information. You know, unless you are signing some sort of legal contract, or you're in court, or you're actually doing a specific legal process, then it's not illegal to give someone a pseudonym. So that's one start. You know, if you want to actually protect your physical address and phone number and stuff, then you need to start figuring out how to use proxies for everything. And this is the way that privacy works as a shield, is that you're using proxies to put another layer of obfuscation between your actual information and whatever you're giving to a third party, because any information you give to a third party, you should assume is going to eventually leak. So that's where a little bit more effort comes in. I mean, you can create throwaway phone numbers very easily with a number of different services. For mailing address, you are going to have to probably spend somewhere between $20 and $50 a month if you want to rent out a box somewhere. If you want to cheap out and your company, if you have like a physical office that will allow you to ship stuff to the office, that's an easy, free way to not put your home information into a bunch of different databases. But there's also, on the internet side of things, in a matter of 10 minutes, you can install a number of different ad blockers in your browser. You can get set up with a VPN in probably less than an hour. And, that will put you in a better position than 99% of people on the internet, just to make it harder for all of these surveillance capitalism websites to track everything that you're doing on the internet.
Jameson, before you move on from that, I've spoken to a lot of security experts, especially because I've tried to put out a lot of content myself to help people level up their security. No one has once mentioned an ad blocker to me yet. Why is that important?
So it's kind of funny, because before I worked in Bitcoin security, I spent my first decade working as a cloud data analytics engineer for an email marketing company that would send out over 100 million emails every day through its platform. We had a ton of different very large e-commerce clients. And so this was really, I was doing the antithesis of what I do today, in that I was collecting petabytes of information and processing it, and helping marketers better target people to sell crap to them. I was never interested in this, as an idea. It just happened to pose an interesting computer science challenge that resulted in this company offering me a nice salary, and put a roof over my head and food on the table for a number of years, but I never found it to be fulfilling. But I think that experience gave me a great deal of insight into exactly how much tracking is going on, because I was the one that was doing it. So it's very easy to stop that tracking. Like I said, there's plenty of tools out there, and it doesn't take more than a few minutes to get set up with them. But even that minuscule resource commitment of a few minutes is well beyond the vast majority of people on the internet. So these surveillance capitalism engines don't really have anything to fear from those ad blockers, because it's only the people who actually think about privacy in the first place that are going to bother.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm going to add that to every resource I currently have. What I try to focus on is the no-brainer easy steps, which you have no reason not to do, because it's very hard to convince people who haven't ever been hacked or suffered some sort of serious security threat to go set up a proxy address or spend X amount of times to get their mail posted X somewhere else and get it a day later. That sort of thing is really hard to communicate, but install an ad blocker, install a VPN, that's pretty easy to get people to do relative to that. So actually, moving away from the simple solutions, if on a macro level you want to solve all of this, how much would it cost to get someone to handle it all for you? Can it even be done without a time investment for those who have the money but don't have the time?
Well, yeah. So, like I said, most of this stuff, it's the same type of problem that celebrities and politicians have to deal with. So there are certainly services out there that will hook you up. I mean, if you've got the money, I've never priced them out myself. The only one that I've ever actually looked at was Michael Bazell, who he wrote the book that I recommend everyone reads. which is Extreme Privacy. The second edition of that just dropped, and it was like twice as long as the first edition. I think it's like 550 pages. He offers a bespoke service. I have no idea how much it costs. I would expect to pay at least $100,000 to get like a full setup. As I have said, I think that I spent around $30,000, and most of that was in legal fees. I spent, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 testing my setup, hiring private investigators to, you know, spend a week trying to track me down. And then I have a lot of ongoing expenses. I think if you exclude the fact that I have like decoy, physical apartments and stuff. Some of those are needed for like driver license, information. I probably spend $500 to $1,000 a month on all my different privacy related services.
So 100K for a one-off cost and then a recurring cost to get that sort of privacy. But that's just the financial side. What is the emotional or non-financial cost of this? I imagine you've had to sacrifice seeing certain friends or family at certain times or occasions simply because it's a security risk. And I could be wrong. Please correct me if I am.
So, you know, I've worked remotely for the entire time I've been working in Bitcoin. So, you know, I've worked from home for 6 years now. So that already drastically reduced my like physical interactions with folks. And then, you know, a few years ago when I burned down my whole life and moved away, you know, that was me cutting ties with all of the friends and family that I had, you know, spent the past 15 years around. So that was a major thing, you know. Then, you know, deleting most of my social media, was another big thing. You know, Facebook, all Facebook related services. Sometimes I will get a random email from someone who's like, "Oh, hey, I hadn't seen you post anything in a few years, you know, what happened?" But I think what that also helped me realize is that I think a lot of those social media services were providing a false sense of connection, because the vast majority of people that I would interact with through those services, I haven't heard from ever since I deleted them. So I suspect that, you know, they don't think about me. I don't think about them. You know, it's just a simple fact of life that, you know, you have a limited amount of time. You know, Dunbar's number is a real thing. You can only reasonably fit so many people into your life at any given point of time. And I think social media artificially inflates that and makes it feel like you can fit more people in your life than you really can. And then, of course, just with me being on Twitter and a few other services, I mean, I have like a dozen different communications channels that are going 24/7. And I never feel alone. I may be physically alone, but I have, you know, so many people that I am regularly interacting with that I'm busy. I'm happy. I'm building. I don't regret any of that. I think the annoying thing was, you know, like, this is always a learning experience. The first time through, when I burned everything down, that was definitely more anxiety inducing because I figured some things would fail, and over the years they did. Mm-hmm. And that was what was really annoying to me, is that I had a few incidents where either an attorney or sometimes a close family member would leak information that I had entrusted them not to do. And this, you know, I didn't hold it against them because this is human nature. They were just doing what they had always done their entire lives. Like, you know, the attorney, you know, might put an address into their database, and then somehow that would get sent to another marketing database. And then I would get like a holiday card to an address with my name on it that should never have happened. You know, extremely frustrating for me, to then have to go, you know, be like, what the hell is this? You know, how did this happen? And so I ended up redoing everything a few years later. And, you know, essentially the result is I can't trust anybody. I can't trust the attorney. I can't trust my own family member. You know, I don't give the family members the real address. If they want to send me something in the mail, they can get a proxy address and that'll work just fine.
I guess that is the one sacrifice that you've mentioned, even though with a lot of the other ones, it seems to be a bit of a blessing, like with Facebook, finding more real connections, focusing more on things you actually care about. And a lot of these things people are attached to, once you lose them, you realize you never wanted it or liked it that much in the first place. And all of this leads nicely into, I mean, Casa, which is what you yourself have built and run. Could you tell us a little bit about the services you provide and what it does?
Yeah, so the best way to think of Casa is that we are helping people be their own bank. We don't want to be people's banks, but we want to provide user-friendly software combined with a high level of service, almost like a private banker level of service, so that, you know, someone who has a great deal of wealth that they're storing in Bitcoin and, you know, wants to self-custody, if they see the value in that, but they don't have the time or they don't want to, you know, invest a lot of resources to figure out, survey the entire ecosystem, go through all of these security best practices that I've been learning for 6 years. That is where the real value comes in, is we are providing, from a technical level, a multi-signature Bitcoin key management solution. But, you know, a lot of people don't even really know what that is. It's easier just to describe it as, you know, we're providing a mobile app interface that is, you know, as easy to use as any of the mainstream apps like your Facebooks and whatnot. But what it's really doing on the back end is helping you maintain a distributed set of keys that, with enough of them combined, can be used to unlock and spend your Bitcoin. And it's the way that these keys are stored and the guidance that we give you for setting up and managing them is how you get yourself into an architecture in which it is robust against single points of failure. If you have a key get lost, stolen, damaged, whatever, then it's no longer a catastrophic loss. We actually have mechanisms built into the system that make it really flexible. So you just go, you know, buy a new hardware device or buy a new phone or whatever, and you can reconstitute your key set, you know, bring yourself back up to full security. So, this is, I would say, a very different model than most, you know, Bitcoin wallets out there. The vast majority of Bitcoin wallets are free software. You download it, you run it, you figure it out. If you're trying to get support for them, you'll be lucky if you can get email support in many cases. You know, in other cases, you know, if you are able to get some level of support from a company, you know, the response times may vary, especially if it's during a bull run when there's a lot of people getting onboarded. And I would say really what you're paying for at Casa is a level of support that we try to be the best in the business. You know, we prioritize a lot on keeping our support system flowing and getting, you know, response times to our premium users, you know, in a matter of hours rather than days or weeks.
So very much based on all the philosophy you've been sharing, the multi-sig removes that single point of failure and employs something I like to do a lot is, if I get hacked, make sure I'm still okay anyway. Or if someone breaches anything, I need to still be okay anyway. And you're definitely someone I'd want to trust with my security, Jameson. you seem to know more than 99.9% of people on the topic and have applied it to your own life. The one thing I'm very curious about with Casa is you can't run the whole thing yourself. So that means you have to trust other people to carry out these same philosophies that you believe in. How do you vet the right people, and what measures do you put in place to make sure that even the CASA employees can't do anything to compromise the security of your customers?
Yeah, I think, you know, I have people come to me and ask if I do consulting services from time to time. And my response is generally, you know, CASA is my consulting service. And what I'm trying to do here is to scale what I could do on my own, but, you know, scale it out so that we can service much higher volume of clients than I would be able to on my own. So I'm, you know, I'm kind of trying to reproduce myself and my philosophy and my security knowledge. So, you know, we have, I would say it's not a particularly unique hiring process, but, you know, there is a philosophy to hiring that A players want to work with A players. And so the most important thing you can do, especially when you're starting out with a very small company, is you have to realize that your culture and your ideology get baked in really early. You have to, you know, define them and keep them as strong as possible, because the likelihood of the culture you know, weakening or changing, you know, as more people come in, that's kind of what you have to guard against. If you're bringing in people who don't align very strongly with your ethos that you started the company with, that's when you risk eroding it, you know, having people start to try to subtly change things. So the most important thing that we can do is, you know, just ask culture fit questions, regardless of what, you know, actual position someone is coming in for, because who knows if 10 years from now they might end up being the manager of an entire department of the company and have, you know, a lot of power over, you know, how that culture is getting disseminated to new people that are coming in. But then also that quality level, the A players hiring A players, like, this is why when you're interviewing at CASA, it's not just, you know, the managers of a particular department that are interviewing you, you get interviewed by all your peers too, because if the peers don't want to work with you for whatever reason, then, you know, we're just going to save ourselves a lot of trouble by not hiring you in the first place. You know, we have had a few people who we've had to part ways with over the years, and it was never because they were bad at their jobs. It's always been culture and personality issues.
Another recurring theme where it's way more important to hire the right people for the company than the right people for the job. And CASA, I would have thought, would be a very unique set culture, given the importance of each member of staff in there. And sorry to repeat a question, but how do you protect, besides the hiring process, are there measures in place where, like, no one employee can compromise the security of customers, if you're comfortable answering that?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is important. So it actually starts from a very fundamental level with our key architecture. And, you know, any given key set that someone sets up with CASA, CASA only ever has one out of the N keys. So our premium tiers have a 3 of 5 and a 3 of 6 multi-signature setup, which means there's 5 total keys and you need 3 of them to add signatures to a transaction in order for it to be valid and accepted by the Bitcoin network. Now, only one of those is held by CASA, and even when I say held by CASA, you know, it's completely offline. We don't keep keys on any of our servers or in any of our databases, because we assume, even though we have, you know, very strong multi-layered security, we have to assume that they might get compromised because they are connected to the internet. So those keys are only held by a handful of security officers. There's, you know, once again, a variety of multi-layered authentication processes and also internal processes like time delays around being able to use that key to add a signature to a customer's requested transaction. There are also just access control. I mean, a lot of this stuff is common cybersecurity stuff. It's not like crypto specific. Like that's the main crypto specific part. The rest of it is just using like principles of least access, such that only a tiny number of people have access to given production systems. If they do access them, then we have alerts that go off, so everybody else knows what's happening. Access to pretty much all of our critical systems is gated by a number of things. Most importantly, physical hardware, specifically YubiKey devices. So, you know, if you want to get into certain systems, you're going to have physical possession of one of a handful of YubiKeys. You know, so that that does a really good job preventing external attackers. Now, the really interesting question with any of this stuff is, well, how do you guard against an internal attacker? How do you guard against an employee that goes rogue and wants to enrich themselves? Because that has happened. There are companies in this space that either the company itself has fully exit scammed, or in some cases, they just hired a malicious employee. Sometimes, possibly even most of the time, the employee was a security professional who was supposed to be there to help everything stay secure. And they, because they knew how the whole system worked, they were able to find the weakness and compromise it. And so to keep malicious code from getting into our app, for example, we have... You have to have rules up front to prevent bad things from happening, but then on the back end, you want to have strong audit trails so that even if something does happen, it's highly unlikely that the attacker would be able to get away with it. So on the front end, like with all of our coding and development and deploy processes, we once again employ YubiKeys so that all of the code has to be cryptographically signed from an authorized GPG key that is stored on a YubiKey. So very hard to fake code. But then if an employee wanted to get malicious code in, they have to get through various two-man rules where they have to get other employees to sign off on reviewing that code. So, you know, no single rogue employee would be able to get away with getting bad code out. There's additional two-man rules around the actual deploy process where non-engineers have to get involved and have to cryptographically sign off on like the creation of our mobile app builds in order for those to get pushed out to the store. So, you know, I'm sure I'm leaving out a number of things, but the whole point is, once again, it's no single gate. It's no single security mechanism. Layers and layers upon security. And then even if somehow all of those layers get compromised, what we're doing is we're creating cryptographic attestations at many of these different levels so that we can say, well, you know, this employee did this at this time, so that, you know, if we had to go back and do some sort of forensic examination, we'd have very strong, mathematically compelling evidence of who was the perpetrator. So, you know, and all of our employees know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not going to put themselves in that position because, you know, they're not going to get away with it.
Incredible. I wasn't expecting anything less. Unsurprisingly, you guys have thought of everything. Okay, Jameson, so we've spoken a lot about privacy and not that much about crypto itself. Do you think Bitcoin will ever reach complete privacy? Because it's not the most private store of wealth out there.
Yeah, so there are some conflicting principles at play here. Specifically, what I think we've learned over the past few years is that the ability to easily audit the monetary supply is throwing out a number of what I would consider extremely strong privacy features that could be added to the protocol. When we talk about some privacy-centric coins like Monero, Zcash, and whatnot, it becomes more difficult to audit them when you can't actually just like sum up the values of all the coins really easily. So Bitcoin probably will not implement things like zero knowledge, proofs, or complete shielding of the values that are being sent. Rather, I think what we're going to see is a different approach. The ability to combine information, the ability to have massive coin joins, for example, I think is a more practical approach. It's been impractical to this point because when you're doing massive coin joins, you're creating extremely large data size transactions. But the ability to have aggregated signatures, which we'll hopefully get in the next year or so, I hope will kind of turbocharge that. There's also work being done, on second layer protocols. You could feasibly have stronger privacy on those layers because you don't have to, you're no longer constrained to work, within the specific consensus mechanisms of Bitcoin. You have a lot more leeway in what you can do. You're essentially creating your own protocol. So, that has, I would say, been one of the more frustrating aspects of Bitcoin. Obviously, we want Bitcoin to be the perfect money, but then you run into conflicting trade-offs when you're trying to do different things. And that kind of goes back to the scaling debate. Everybody wants Bitcoin to be lightning fast and extremely cheap and extremely easy to use. We want it to be perfect, but whenever you try to push the protocol in one direction or another, you're usually leaving something else behind. And due to the nature of how difficult it is to get consensus changes into this system, that's why I believe that the sort of game theory behind all of this, it doesn't necessarily lead to an outcome where we end up with perfect money. I would say it results in a system that converges on changes that are the least harmful to as many people as possible, not necessarily the best for everyone, but the least harmful for everyone. And it's hard to quantify or predict exactly how that's going to play out, but I would say that, especially from seeing the result of the scaling debates and other protocol changes over the years, that just seems to be what you get when you have a system where the default governance of the system is veto. The default is no. I would say the strength of Bitcoin from a protocol change perspective, it's kind of the strength of not having to do anything and to be able to ignore proposals. You don't have to take action. You have to be convinced to take action to accept changes. And that's why I gave a very lengthy talk a few years ago, which I called blockchains for inverting bureaucracy with blockchains. But of course, the blockchain part is irrelevant. That's just a data structure. It's about the way that a system of independently running nodes converges on consensus and how consensus is formed. Is that instead of being this hierarchical type of system where you have a few actors at the top that then they pass down orders to other layers beneath them, it's a bottom up where you have all of these nodes at the bottom and they individually decide what they want to accept, and then the protocol naturally converges on kind of the least common denominator, and consensus sort of bubbles up from there. So it's that's just another reason why I find these systems so fascinating, is they've changed a lot more than just money. I think it's potentially a blueprint for an entirely new form of human coordination.
Does that have to come from Bitcoin, though? Could it not be Bitcoin integrated with different decentralized finances?
Well, I mean, I think people are going to try to integrate as many of these systems as possible to, you know, make, you know, frictionless finance. I think that the vast majority, if not all, of the quote unquote governance schemes that I've seen in the space are laughable. And the reason for that, I mean, you obviously, if you want to build voting, you can build voting. I mean, you can build whatever you want. You know, we now have the power to architect whatever rules we want. But the reason I find most of these governance schemes laughable is because I believe that they are a veneer on top of the true governance of any of these protocols, which is a bunch of individually independent actors running software that defines the rules of the protocol. So to be more specific, you can build a protocol in which people are using tokens to vote on whatever aspects of, you know, maybe distributions of other tokens in the protocol or whatever. You know, this is essentially recreating democracy. I mean, I consider democracy to be like a tyranny of the majority. There are certainly pros and cons to it, but ultimately, if some minority is upset with the way that some governance action within the rules of that protocol has proceeded, no one can stop them from forking off and creating their own different rule sets and resetting everything. So I think that, you know, you may be able to create a little bit better coordination through some of these schemes. But once again, unless everybody agrees to abide by those rules, you can't actually enforce it. You can't stop anyone from going off and creating their own rules. And that is really one of the reasons why this space is so hectic and hard to keep track of, is because people are free to do whatever they want. And, you know, I get questions all the time of like, what do I think of random cryptocurrency X, Y, or Z? And the answer is, I have no idea, because this system has exploded to a level of complexity that no one can keep track of it. And I am still 99% focused on Bitcoin, just trying to keep track of everything that's going on within that single space.
Well, you've just answered one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which is that you said if something gives you more freedom than Bitcoin, you will swap to it instantly. I mean, has anything even come close to tempting you? Have you seen potential in anything in the initial phases and then seen it to be nothing more than subpar Bitcoin?
Well, and to be specific about that quote, I wasn't even constraining that to things in the crypto sphere. I mean, I have obviously used a non-negligible amount of funds to improve my privacy and improve my freedom, you know, from that standpoint. Like, I consider that, you know, privacy and security to be more valuable than the like corresponding amount of Bitcoin that I could have bought instead. But, you know, if, for example, I can, set up my Citadel, whatever that means, right? Set up some fairly sovereign piece of land, which will once again, you know, give me more security and privacy, then yes, I will probably trade some of my Bitcoin for that. Kind of from a far future looking view, I think I've said this before, is that, you know, I'm holding my Bitcoin for life extension technology, for digitization of my consciousness, and ultimately decentralization of my consciousness to rid myself of this single point of failure that is this body. And I'm holding my Bitcoin for a ticket off this godforsaken rock.
Wow, you just hit us with three huge topics over there. Have you seriously pursued or looked into any of those last three you mentioned?
I do need to look into the like Alcor as a sort of fail-safe backup. I know a number of people in Bitcoin have cryo preservation, and Hal Finney being one of the most prominent. But that's kind of like a emergency backup thing. I do hope that in the next few decades we will find ourselves, if humanity can survive, we'll find ourselves at the crux of this major inflection point. Hopefully, when computing and AI gets to the point that we can essentially get rid of a lot of the need for a lot of menial tasks, and hopefully create enough wealth that people will generally be free to pursue the things that they find most fulfilling. And then hopefully, that exponential explosion in technology will also occur in the biomedical sector and allow us to extend the life of our current bodies, our current forms, and then eventually figure out how to manifest our consciousness in other forms that aren't so fragile. But that's starting to get into transhumanism. These are the things that I am hopeful for. If we can avoid, I can never remember what it's called, but there's a theory that most civilizations in the universe essentially snuff themselves out before they're able to become, interstellar space travelers. So, we just have to get through the hard part.
Yeah, I've definitely heard the same theory when destructive technology just increases with the creative technology as well. So people just end up destroying themselves. Jameson, again, just like with the security, you fought so much further ahead than I have. I mean, I've thought of maybe when I take the turn 40, I'll try HRT to stay a little longer, but you got bio enhancements on the menu. I need to research that a little more. And heck, we could probably do an entire podcast talking about that because it's another fascinating topic. But alas, we're reaching the 1 hour mark. So Jameson, let's finish off with a crowd pleaser. What are your Bitcoin price predictions, and what do you think will happen next year? This doesn't have to be a specific singular point you think it's going to reach, because I know a lot of people think that's useless information. What do you think the general trend is going to be, especially given the current world economic situation?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've always found price predictions to be nonsensical because, it would make sense if you are only thinking about it from a like Bitcoin adoption and therefore number go up perspective. But the reason they're nonsensical is because you're pricing Bitcoin in fiat and there's no floor on the value of fiat. So, you can look at it from both ways. At a very high level, it seems like the hype cycles are generally like 5x to 10x in terms of exchange rate. But then there's also the this time is different scenario. And, this time is different. It seems like every time is different. But this one is definitely different from the macro perspective of how much fiat is being printed. So, I would be surprised if Bitcoin does more than 10x from the previous all-time high, which would be like around $200,000. You're the trader, market psychology better than I do. It just seems to me like when people see order of magnitude increase, that's when they start to think, maybe I should take some money off the table here. I don't claim to understand those perspectives myself, but because I've never sold a substantial amount of Bitcoin, I've still held, some of the original coins I got on MT Gox, for example. And the reason that I've held them is for what we just talked about, is that I've never really found anything else that I was compelled to believe that was going to be better for me than holding the Bitcoin, even during those crazy hype cycles. I should have sold when it hit $1,000 and I could have bought back lower. I could have sold when it hit 20,000, bought back lower. But like in reality, because I'm not a trader, I don't pay attention to the markets on a granular basis. I didn't have time. Like, I would have missed those things. Like, you know, the exponential blow-offs happen so quickly in a matter of days, if not hours, that me trying to time them is actually impossible in my current setup, because I don't have direct access to enough keys to move the coins in the first place. So, you know, Casa is also good for hodling from that perspective. You know, you're not able to panic sell. We have a number of traders that use Casa, and I would say, and what I've said for a while, is that the good traders that I've talked to, they don't denominate their gains in fiat. They denominate their gains in Bitcoin. And what they end up doing is they keep building up their long-term Bitcoin stash. They put that into Casa as their long-term storage. And then they have their trading stash, which is, you know, probably less than 10% of their total holdings. And that's what they keep in lower security wallets or in, you know, various exchanges and actually do their active trading with. So, you know, that is... Trading is probably my like weakest area of knowledge. I would say that the few trades I've done over the years, I would have been better off if I hadn't. But live and learn.
Well, you have the self-awareness to, one, know that hodling serves you much better, and two, you said you're not a trader, but you've given a better answer than most traders do, which will be one random singular number that they think it's going to reach next year. Instead, you've given a very all-encompassing answer, which takes into account your specific personality and situation, which applies to it, because there's no way you're going to be pinpoint an exact level it's going to get to, because the value of it, even though the asset is beautiful and fundamentally all this dollar printing is bad for it, it's only worth what people think it's worth. That's what's going to be. And you can't predict that sort of human irrationality with anything close to pinpoint accuracy. So a fantastic answer to finish stuff off. Jameson, thank you so much for taking this time on New Year's Eve to come on and help educate our listeners on crypto security. This has been a huge value add episode. Is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap it off? And that could be you've hopefully had a great time, goodbye, or some sort of advice, or even an advertisement for any of your services.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we didn't really get to talk about is just wealth in general, and that, you know, this is something I also haven't spent a lot of time looking into, but I'm starting to look into it now. And it's once again, it kind of goes back to like why I didn't sell a lot of my Bitcoin for fiat during previous run-ups. And it's a question of, you know, what is the point of this wealth? You know, let's say that you're in the crypto ecosystem and you've gone through a whole bull cycle and, you know, your wealth has exploded by an order of magnitude or more. This can be very overwhelming. I think it's a good example of like why so many early holders don't have much of their Bitcoin left, is because it's just too tempting to trade it for something else. You feel overweight in Bitcoin as an asset. You feel like you have to diversify. But what I'm starting to think of now, just at a higher level, is that, you know, the point of wealth is to be productive and is to serve society. It is to create a legacy for yourself. The point of wealth is not a circular, logical thing of to make more wealth. Like, what is the point of that? You know, okay, if the numbers in your accounts keep going up and you're not actually using them for anything productive to yourself, your family, society at large, then, I mean, it's like you're playing a zero-sum game. I don't know why anyone would find that to be fulfilling. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who find that fulfilling, but, you know, my reasoning for getting into this space in the first place, it was never to become wealthy. Like, I had no idea that, you know, the exchange rate would go up so quickly over the past number of years. You know, I bought Bitcoin because I saw it as a hedge against my fiat value going down, not as some sort of get rich quick scheme. But then the reason why I went full time into Bitcoin is because I decided to make a mission for myself. And the mission is to use my skills as a technologist to empower individuals to, you know, try to take as much power away from large institutions, from governments, you know, from any centralized source of power, and build tools that give more leverage to individuals to be sovereign. So, you know, as I'm thinking about this in the context of the wealth that I have been fortunate enough to find myself coming into through Bitcoin, my goal is going to be to figure out how to use that wealth to further that mission. If I stop, you know, being a CTO and building full-time Bitcoin stuff, you know, if we get to the point where I feel like Bitcoin security has been solved and is user-friendly enough, then there's going to be another mission out there. There's going to be other technology that will help empower people. And I'm going to use all of my resources to keep working on that, to keep using the ability for software to empower people. So, you know, I think that's going to keep me busy for the rest of my life. And I just hope that everyone else who's, you know, been lucky enough to find wealth through this system will be able to come up with some mission on their own. You know, it doesn't have to be that, but there's so many terrible things in the world today. Each of those is a problem and each problem has a solution. So I just think people should be looking at their wealth as a tool for finding more solutions.
I'm going to expand on that because that was a beautiful point to round off this podcast with. I fully agree that you can use your wealth to do so, but any resource whatsoever. So something I found personally has leveled up my wealth and the amount of value I can add to society is previously, having been an entrepreneur for the last 6 years, I have looked for sales arbitrage opportunities, like a business where I can make money by finding some sort of arbitrage. But all of these ended eventually. Like they weren't long-term or sustainable. And the reason for that was they weren't solving any problem. They weren't actually delivering value for society. For even from a purely selfish standpoint, taking your advice and building things that are actually solving problems and making the world a better place will help your longevity, wealth-wise, health-wise, mentally, and or even your social circles, because you're providing value to society. People are going to want to spend more time with you and work with you and build with you.
Exactly. So, you know, we're fortunate to be in the position that we get to worry about these type of things. And you know, hopefully these systems will continue to free more and more people from a financial standpoint so that they too have, you know, the time and the resources to worry about these, you know, these higher, you know, on like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, you need to get past having to worry about your food security, your home security, your, you know, 6 month financial security. Like once you have that financial security, that is an amazing level of freedom that then allows you to really focus on whatever you want.
Beautiful. Jameson, thank you again for your time. Meditators, thank you for tuning in again for another episode of the Market Meditations podcast. I will see you again next time. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Market Meditations podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like us to continue bringing you fascinating people from across the world, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you like to listen to these podcasts, and share the episode with a friend. If you have feedback or an idea for a potential guest, reach out to me on Twitter at KarushAK, and do not forget we write a newsletter covering all important topics in crypto and traditional markets. We send it out 3 times a week. The Market Meditations newsletter. You also get early access to these episodes and you get transcripts and extra notes as well. So make sure to subscribe there as well.